Well, I'm in the Racing Post offices today with editor Bruce Millington. Thank you, Bruce, for agreeing to do this. Can we start from basically your background? What is your background and when you first became aware of or interested in horse racing?
Blimey, I grew up in South Norwood in South London. You know, we're probably 20 miles from the nearest horse. Family and friends had no interest whatsoever. And it was probably only when I was about 12, my eldest brother's friend, his dad died and he came to live with us, and he was into horse racing. He used to have a few bets on a Saturday afternoon, and I used to sit there and go. Before that, I'd kind of thought horse racing, I was just football mad non-stop, and I kind of thought horse racing was, you know, I'd never really engaged with it, but then I started cheering his bets on and getting into it that way, and gradually, well, not gradually, very quickly actually, that grew into quite a passion. You know, so it was stimulated through betting. And, you know, I suppose as I went through my teens, I just got more and more into it. And when I was about, I think it was 17, I went to White City for their last ever meeting, White City Grounds. It was the Derby final. And it was, I was absolutely captivated. And then after that, I went to Catford Dogs. And I used to go to Catford Dogs three nights a week from when I was about 16, 17. Have a few bets, we just basically lived and breathed it. Loved my racing as well. Just and I was at school at the time, and I started. I did half a term of A levels, but I just wanted to work, and I wanted to work in the betting industry. So I wrote to all the major bookmakers at the time and said, "Have you got anything?" And Mecca Bookmakers wrote back and offered me a job in their credit office in central London. So I was. Just turned 17 and I started work there I had three jobs. One, I was a board marker, so it was the credit office, all the banks of telephonists. Obviously there was no internet in those days, this was 1984. And there was a huge board at the end, and I had to, you know, do the old board marking, write the results up, put the shows up, and then I'd go around and collect the slips that the telephonist's hand wrote the bets on, and put them through a camera before the race so that they could be verified. And I absolutely loved that. That was fantastic. Worked with some really lovely people, got bang into it. And from then on, really, I just knew that that was what I wanted to do.
How did that progress into journalism then?
Well, funny enough, I'd always wanted to be a sports journalist. I mean, it was a kind of a bit of a lofty ambition, not really something that I ever thought would happen. But I left Mecca in the summer of 85, because there was a job advertised at Hackney Greyhound Track in the racing office, and I was quite intrigued by it. It's advertised in the Evening Standard, and I went for it and got it, and that was absolutely fantastic. I did a year at Hackney, you know, those incredible Saturday morning meetings when everyone was there punting away eight races. It was absolutely superb. And I ended up being assistant racing manager at Hackney. Loved it to bits, but I got to know some of the journalists from the sporting life, notably Bob Betts, who's, you know, remains a close friend and you know, someone. I guess in my career, you know, a small number of people have opened doors for me, without which I would never have got anywhere near where I was, you know, where I have done. And Bob's really the main guy. He, you know, I got to know him really well. He's a lovely, lovely fellow, absolute gent. And I said to him, look, you know, ultimately, I'd really fancy getting into newspapers. And he said, well, okay, well, I'll see if anything crops up at the Sporting Life. In the meantime, after a year at Hackney, a similar vacancy in the racing office as assistant racing manager at Catford materialised. And Catford was nearer to where I lived. It was the track I used to go to. I absolutely love Catford. So I went there and did another year at Catford. And again, just magical times. Loved it to bits. It was just incredible, the characters you meet and the adventures and the stuff that happened. It was just phenomenal. But then Bob said to me, look, I can get you some shifts on the Sporting Life. So I said, great. And I was doing some casual shifts while still working at Catford. And then towards the back end of 1986, Robert Maxwell had this idea of opening up a rival newspaper to the London Evening Standard. And you know, in those days, every paper had a Greyhound correspondent. And Maxwell's obviously owned the Sporting Life at that point, and he said to the guys at the Life, at the London Daily News, you're not allowed to take anyone from the Life. So Bob put me in for this job. I was only 19, and I got it. And so I became Greyhound correspondent for the London Daily News, which I was absolutely thrilled to bits with, you know, really couldn't believe it was happening. And had 6 really fantastic months there, but unfortunately the paper folded. So from there, I freelanced for about 9 months at the Sporting Life, at the Independent, at the Telegraph, at the Mirror, and then a job came up at the Sporting Life on the Greyhound desk. And so in the April of 1988, I joined the staff there full time.
So the greyhounds have really been a bigger part of your early development than the horse racing.
Well, greyhounds were what I worked in, but I mean, I think, you know, at that time, the 3 big shows in town, as far as betting were concerned, were horse racing, greyhound racing and dogs. And I kind of embraced all 3 pretty passionately, you know. I mean, I was going to Cheltenham every year from 1985, and you know, I absolutely loved racing. I worked in greyhounds, and obviously that was you know my profession, if you like, at that time. But and I was mad on horses as well. I just loved all 3 really. I've always been very enthusiastic punter, and you know, in those days I was betting on those 3. Obviously now it's proliferated; you can bet on pretty much anything, and you know, I tend to do that as well. But that was a really happy period, you know. But then obviously, getting onto the Sporting Life was great because it gave me, you know, the security of a staff job. And again, you know, Sporting Life Greyhound Desk was the most fun I ever had working. I think some of the characters there are just absolutely legendary. And, you know, you're getting paid to go greyhound racing and report on greyhound racing. It was just phenomenal.
This is the second time I've been lucky enough to come to the Racing Post offices. I must admit I was stunned at the amount of people that work here. It's a massive operation. How many people does the paper employ?
We've got 300 full-time employees, plus we've got some developers working off-site as well. So it's a big operation now. And if I look at the difference between now and 30 years ago when I was on the Life, it was basically journalists on the Life, and then you had a personnel department of a couple of people. Someone did the accounts. There was a general manager to hold it all together. You know, now you've got product teams, marketing, tech, you know, it's a huge operation.
So you've obviously come up through the ranks and you're now the editor of, you know, the biggest sort of racing paper in the country. How do you cope with the pressures of running a publication that's published 7 days a week?
I mean, to be honest, you say publishing 7 days a week. I mean, that was certainly the kind of regime I worked to when, you know, I became editor in 2007, because the paper was absolutely the king, and it's probably still the most important product that we produce, but it's one of a number of products. So it's kind of those 7 print deadlines are really just a kind of aggregation of everything we've been doing during the previous 24 hours digitally. So, you know, we operate on a digital first basis. Our aim is to break stories first and fastest on social media, develop them online, deliver them on mobile, and then aggregate what we've done in newspaper and iPad form in terms of the daily edition. In terms of pressure, I mean, I don't really see it as pressure. My wife is a paediatric nurse, and, you know, I quickly learned that, you know, having a comma in the wrong place is, you know, kind of irrelevant compared to you know, what she does when, you know, she's dealing with children who are hiding under the bed because they've got their first bout of chemotherapy and they don't want a needle stuck in them, you know. So it that keeps you in perspective. That's not to say that I have a laissez-faire attitude, obviously. I mean, you know, there is pressure. There's every second is a deadline. And that's what I love about digital publishing. You know, if you get a story now, you don't have to sit on it and hope that no one's got it during the day. You can just bosh it straight out there, and that's good. We don't like getting beaten to stories. We don't like, you know, we don't like mistakes. Those are the kind of things that bring a bit of pressure. But like I say, I mean, it's not. I've quickly learned that pressure is relative.
So you're in what some might see as a precarious position, having to write and report on what's a small community and group of sports. How do you balance between getting good stories out there but not upsetting people in the game, so to speak?
Yeah, it's slightly different for us. I mean, if you're one of the national dailies, I guess you're outside the village to an extent. We're very much inside the village, and you have to, you know, you do have to tread carefully. At the same time, though, you know, we're a newspaper, and people have to understand that. I mean, you get situations where people say, well, why did you do that? And you kind of think, well, because we're a newspaper, that's what we do, you know. It can be difficult, but, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, we've got a responsibility to make sure that we cover the sport, you know, with passion, with authority, comprehensively. We help to promote it when it needs promoting, but also to criticise and to question and to probe when it needs it. So, you know, I mean, we do what we do, and obviously, you know, sometimes you get flack, and sometimes the only way you can tell whether you've dealt with something as fairly as possible is that you're getting kind of equal amounts of flack from both sides of an argument, if you like. And, you know, that's you know, not really how you want to be judged, but sometimes that's the only way you can tell that you've done something well.
So you talk about the flack. What would you say to people that would sometimes accuse you of giving people an easy ride because of their prominent position in racing or greyhound racing?
I don't think we do, to be honest. I mean, I can't think of any examples of where that would, you know, be a justified accusation. I'm not aware that that happens. I am well aware that whatever you do now, you're going to get flack, unfortunately. You know, I mean, you know, I always say if Mother Teresa was on Twitter, she gets slagged off. You know, it's a pretty kind of negative kind of environment at times. And, you know, you if you choose to put yourself in it, you have to expect that you're going to get flack. But at the same time, you know, there's people who criticise who it doesn't particularly bother me. And there's a few people who, you know, it does, but you have to learn to live with it.
And on a more positive note there, what would be the most memorable issue of the Racing Post that you've put together in your time as editor?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a very sad occasion, but I thought we did Henry Cecil's death really well. And by that, I mean, I hope we did him and his family and his memory proud, because Cecil was such a sensational story, his comeback from Night Shift winning the Oaks and then obviously through to Frankel, was just, just such a magnificent story. And then, you know, the tragedy of his death. But, you know, I felt like the day after he died, the Racing Post that we put out that day, I was really proud of, because so much has to go right in those situations in order to be able to get it exactly how you want it. And the team absolutely responded and was superb. And when I say team, it's not just the writers, it's the subs, it's the graphics people, it's everyone. Everyone came together and we produced something that I thought was really special. And yeah, that's the one that I think I was most proud of.
Thanks, Bruce. Obviously, there's quite a few topics at the moment flying around where people have got very strong opinions on. Can I ask what your personal opinion on the FOBTI sort of dilemma is at the moment? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think that any business or any sport or any organisation that finds itself a kind of hostage to what happens with the triennial review can't feel particularly good about themselves. And, it's a time of concern for those that are, and I'll be absolutely frank here, you know, the Racing Post is one of them. You know, we obviously sell newspapers into betting shops. The more betting shops there are, the more we sell, and you know, conversely, the fewer there are, the fewer we sell. So, you know, it doesn't stand to do us any good. But at the same time, you know, you have to accept that if these machines are proven, and that the evidence says that they're causing significant social harm, and the evidence obviously, you know, needs to be slightly more substantial than a newspaper campaign, then they need to be limited accordingly. I don't think anyone who's remotely sane or responsible or has any kind of, you know, moral sort of, you know, sense, if you like, can argue against that. So look, if the limit needs to be 20, it's 20. If the limit needs to be 2, it's 2. everyone has to live with that. Racing has to live with that. Bookmakers have to live with that. You know, a lot of boats have risen with the FOB T tide, and they're going to have to see how they cope when they fall with that tide. I think from racing's point of view, which is how we've really been reporting this, it is a big worry, because if you look at prize money, it's the fuel that keeps the whole industry running. It's the thing that enables trainers and jockeys and to earn a living, and for owners to be engaged with the sport. And if prize money goes down, and don't forget, it got a huge boost recently when the offshore levy, for which racing did so well to broker, when that kicked in, that gave prize money a massive lift. That could be eroded, you know, almost entirely, that boost by a £2 FOB T limit. But you know, we have to accept that and move on, and we'll see where we go with it. But I don't think anyone should underestimate the importance of the issue in terms of racing, and what it might mean. But like I say, at the end of the day, if the evidence is there that these things need a very, very hefty cut in the maximum stake, then that's what needs to happen. Because, you know, ultimately you have to, you know, social responsibility comes above all else, I think.
And you mentioned prize money. There's been a lot of criticism from some quarters that there's far too much racing. Would maybe that not be, you know, the answer, to have less racing, more prize money, and focus on that?
I don't think less racing and more prize money go hand in hand. I mean, I think that, you know, you need to have plenty of, you need, there's an optimal amount of races and fixtures that take place in order to generate the betting turnover that fuels prize money. So I'm not sure that having fewer races is necessarily going to help in that sense. I mean, I do think that if, you know, if prize money does take a big hit as a consequence of what happens with the FOB T's and the consequent loss of media rights revenue for the sport, that it's going to put a lot of strain on the horse population. And I think that's a big worry. I think the two big challenges the racing industry faces is to retain owners and also to retain stable staff. I mean, that's an acute issue that is, you know, going to come to the surface very soon, regardless of what happens with FOB T's, I think.
So how would you regard the health of the horse racing industry now compared to like 10 years ago?
Stronger, definitely. I mean, you know, if you look at what's happened to racing since 2001, when basically Gordon Brown made the changes to betting tax, racing has definitely benefited from that. And I think, you know, there's been some good work by racecourses to boost attendances, albeit most of them are on the back of, you know, a Rita Ora concert rather than necessarily a grade two handicap. But, you know, there are challenges ahead. We have to make sure that, you know, the phenomenally wealthy people who invest so heavily in the sport continue to do so. And we need to make sure that betting remains a trustworthy, relevant and enjoyable betting proposition in the face of all the challenges from, you know, virtuals, from football, from everything else. So I think racing's done well. It, like I say, it does face a lot of challenges, but it also faces plenty of opportunities.
You mentioned the concerts, which I think everybody would agree have been successful, at least in getting people to go to race courses. Do you think that, by and large, the race courses do enough to try and engage people with the racing once they're there?
It's so difficult. Because, I mean, I took my daughter to Newmarket a few years ago to see Jessie J, and the place was absolutely swarming with, you know, young kids. I mean, some of them were paying attention. I'll tell you one thing I would say about that, and he's a guy who comes in for a lot of stick, but I thought Derek Thompson was on the mic that night, and he did a really good, he got it just right in terms of not patronising the people who weren't hardcore racing fans, but also not completely, you know, overwhelming them with jargon and just, you know, the kind of mysterious lexicon that racing has. It's very difficult. I think you've just got to basically get them there and hope that some of them, while that's not their primary reason for being there, do actually see that there's a fairly fascinating sporting event taking place in front of their eyes.
Grassroots racing during the week, it's quite obvious that sort of very few bookmakers attend these days. Some places very sparse attendance. How do you see, you know, what could we do, what could racing do to try and improve its bread and butter?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? You've got kind of two very distinct types of people who go racing. You've got the people who go for an event, so to the big meetings, and then you've got the hardcore, probably mostly older people who've got the time and the interest to go to Plumpton on a Monday or whatever. I think for those people, the key is to make sure their day out is as good value as possible. And I think if I look at some of the midweek entry prices, I think they're too high. I think they could do some more in terms of maybe season tickets and loyalty and that kind of thing. Because I just feel that to go and see half a dozen low-grade races, you know, on an all-weather track, and to pay in excess of 20 quid to do that, I think that's, you know, that's pretty excessive. And that would be a deterrent for a lot of people who can now just, you know, go onto their mobile phone, place a bet, and then click the Bet to View logo, and they can do it there without needing to get a train and traipse from the station to the course. But at the same time, you know, I think that, if I get a rare day in the week and I'm able to go to Plumpton or to Fontwell or to Lingfield, which are my local courses, you know, I absolutely love it. I think it's superb. And I'm always amazed how many people there are there. So I think they're doing something right, for sure. You have to also remember that those meetings are there to generate betting turnover. You know, they're not there to get loads of people through the gate. But, you know, the one thing I would say about who racing needs to attract to the courses is that, in the same way that nightclubs might turn around and say there's no 70 and 80 year olds in their nightclubs, it would be stupid to try and get them in there because people of that age don't go to nightclubs. I think if you're trying to fill Plumpton or Lingfield or Fakenham on a Tuesday afternoon, you need to look at mid 50s and upwards. Those are the people who you can convert more easily, I think, than young people. So I remember one of the more kind of risible enterprises that racing undertook was this thing which you may remember called, I think they termed it Brian and Ben, and they decided they needed more Bens, who were these kind of affluent 20-somethings, than Brians, who were slightly sort of crustier people. But I actually think Brians are the people you do need to look at. So, you know, one thing I would say about racing is that I think it's almost paranoid in how kind of introspective and how self-analytical it is sometimes. But I also think that really intense desire to get it as right as possible does actually bear a lot of fruit. And there's certainly no complacency in the racing industry or from race courses to try and make sure that we've got as much interest as possible. And they, you know, this is where the Racing Post is happy to play a part and needs to play a part, because obviously we're hostage to racing's fortunes. What's good for racing is good for Racing Post. If there's plenty of interest in horse racing, then we hope that, you know, that will lead to plenty of interest in people wanting to, you know, interact with the sport through our products. And so, you know, we're absolutely four square behind any attempts to increase interest in racing in whatever form it takes.
So obviously the Racing Post is the racing industry paper, and you primarily report the news and things. Do you think you could take a bit more of a proactive part in trying to attract more people to the races, or do you think that's not really your...
Well, no, I think it is our part of what we should be doing, for sure, and I think it's something we absolutely do, you know. I mean, if you look at our front covers on Saturday editions, which are obviously the big days and the days where, you know, there's a lot of flow of kind of once-a-week race goers who are extremely important, you know, our front pages are absolutely designed to excite and to engage and get people really revved up for the day ahead, so... You know, it's not just that. I mean, we'll happily give editorial space to promote events that are taking place or worthwhile causes. You know, we very much see ourselves, while absolutely an independent, media organisation, we back racing, you know, absolutely to the hilt and do everything we can to make sure that it's popular and stable and successful.
Just one last question on that sort of thing. You're obviously a big fan of greyhound racing. What are your opinions on the decline of that sport, and can it be reversed?
it's just so sad. I mean, you know, when I think back to the time when I first started working at those tracks, Hackney and Catford, I think in the very first month at Hackney, there was a competition called the William Hill Lead, which was won by a dog called Ballyregan Bob. You know, then emerged this phenomenon called Skirlo Champ, you know. And I remember, I mean, one of the maddest things that ever happened when I was working at Catford, the racing manager was on holiday. I was basically in charge running the whole racing operation. I was 18 years old. And they entered Skirlo Champ for a marathon over 888 metres, one-off race. And I was absolutely, I couldn't believe it. The place was absolutely packed. There were 5,000 people in Catford Dog Track, and it was only a small place. It was absolutely rammed. A minute before the race, the guy who operates the photo finish equipment came out to me and he says, "We've got a problem." I said, "What?" He goes, "We've run out of film." So I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "It means there's no photo finish." And this was the time when Skirlo Champ was on this magnificent winning run. It was absolutely huge. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I know exactly what's going to happen. This dog's going to come from a mile behind like it always does and join the leader right on the line. It's going to be neck and neck, and I'm going to have to try and make some sort of photo finish call with a naked eye. Meanwhile, I've got to hand time the thing with an old stopwatch. So I'm absolutely under massive, massive pressure. But thankfully, this was one of Skirlo Champ's rare occasions when he broke pretty evenly with them. He took it up with a lap to go and won by about 20 lengths. I've never been so happy. But, you know, that was just a phenomenal day. You don't get that anymore. You don't get these star greyhounds running in front of thousands and thousands of people. And it's so sad. I did a column recently about the greyhound tracks I'd visited or been to or worked at that are no longer there. And I counted 21 of them. And you know, it breaks your heart because they were all fantastic places in their own right. They all had their own character, their own traits, but they also had, more importantly, their own community. You know, people who, that was their social life. They went to their local greyhound track. And to just snuff that out and to leave them, you know, bereft of their familiar routine, their social circle, you know, it's so, so sad. I guess the only thing I would say with greyhound racing in terms of its future that's kind of positive is that I think the sport continues to be very popular as a betting medium in terms of both betting shops and also foreign operators. I'm surprised at how much take up there is in mainland Europe as well for British greyhound racing. I mean, I was on holiday in Mykonos in Greece last year, and we're walking through these lovely little lanes, whitewashed buildings, blue domed churches, and my wife and my daughter were looking at some handbag shop or something. I looked through the window of this building, and there was a screen with a 232 at Yarmouth on it. So I walked in, there's all these Greek guys in there punting on British greyhound racing. And while that exists, and while betting becomes more of a global thing, you'd hope that British greyhound racing is a product that, you know, of overseas operators and obviously domestic operators still cherish. So I think that, and my hope for greyhound racing is that it will continue to be stable and that it's reached rock bottom in terms of the number of tracks, because there needs to be X number of tracks in order to service the industry. There needs to be X number of dogs to be able to do that. The one regret I've got is that fantastic design at Wimbledon didn't come off, because I think if they'd done that, and I think if you'd proved that if you provide fantastic facilities, you will actually bring back the good times, then I think you might have found other tracks do it, either renovating themselves and becoming really good, or even new tracks opening. But I just feel that was a really missed opportunity at Wimbledon.
Final section then, Bruce. I assume that you're interested in punting, or is that not the case?
No, very much so. I mean, I got into racing through betting, and you know, that passion for it has never ever left me, never at all. I mean, I just love betting. Bet most days, bet on pretty much every sport there is, and just enjoy it. I mean, it just, you know, I find it invigorating and adds a new sort of dimension to my life, really.
So what were your biggest successes, and people like to hear about the near misses?
I mean, I could drone on about near misses for ages, but I always find hard luck stories are some of the most boring and people don't really want to know about them. My biggest win was Steve Palmer at Golf Tips, who's an absolutely superb judge. It's funny with Steve because I think people, you know, remember him or look at his Sunday column and look at the kind of haphazard, slightly unorthodox way he approaches life, if you like. But as a golf tipster and as a journalist and as an operator, he's so professional, it's unbelievable. But he's a very, very good golf tipster. Anyway, obviously there's two tournaments most weeks, one in Europe or Asia and one in America. And I tend to do each way doubles on his selections. And I've had a couple of really good successes. One of them, probably 7 or 8 years ago, he had, I think, they were big price. I can't remember the exact size. And even though I buckled and laid off a bit, it was still a decent win. So yes, I owe Steve Palmer plenty of beers still for that.
You mentioned you've got some very talented people writing and tipping for the Racing Post. A lot of punters buy the paper to be better informed, you know, in their quest to beat the bookies. How should they feel when they eventually achieve that and then they struggle to get £20 bets on with some of the big firms that possibly even advertise with you?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a problem, and it's something that's come to light recently. I took part in a debate in Parliament recently on the subject, and you know, my concern is that increasingly those kind of clued up but still recreational punters who might bet somewhere between 20 and £50 and who I consider to be our core audience, they're almost getting this kind of thou shalt not win philosophy from the bookmakers thrown in their face. I think, you know, anyone who's just price matching or arbing or whatever you want to call it, I have no sympathy with them. And I also happen to take the view that I don't believe the betting industry, like any other industry, should support professional punters and should just keep writing checks to them. I just don't think that that's, you know, realistic to expect that to happen. But what I do expect to be realistic and should happen is that, you know, the guys who might win, say, between three and 7 or 8 grand by being shrewd and being selective, you know, I don't think that their activity should be shut down as brutally as I'm hearing they are by some firms these days. So, you know, my attitude was always, we'll try and give you the best information and the best help, the best tips, the best form, the best data, et cetera, to be able to find winners. You know, you guys are going to have to do what you can to get on. Now, it's difficult because, you know, in the same way that no bookmaker ever tells me how much the Racing Post should cost, you know, do I have a right to ask or to dictate to bookmakers how they should run their businesses? But all I'm saying is that if you take away that aspiration that every punter has to become successful and to win, you know, not life-changing amounts, but decent money, I don't think that's right. And I just think you need to establish a line where, you know, it's fair and sensible to let good recreational punters, you know, get a decent bet on in that debate, Richard Flint at Skybet said that they write a check of about £7 million to their restricted punters. So they're winning punters who they factor quite heavily. They still lose £7 million a year to them. And, you know, if you're a Skybet shareholder, you could say, well, hang on a sec, why are we doing that? But, you know, at the same time, you have to expect to lose off some people because you're winning off the majority, aren't you?
Now, we know that social media these days is something we can't get away from. We'll publicise this video on social media and no doubt people will comment on it. Everything you do personally as a paper, because you're on social media, you're going to get people that are going to respond to you. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think you can escape it. You can quite easily escape it. You just don't go on it. Last summer, after we wrote a piece about the whip and suggesting that the whip should be banned, because not because we're particularly against the whip, but because we feel that society at some point in the next 15 or 20 years is going to decide that whipping horses in the name of sport isn't acceptable, it provoked a furious reaction. I was taken aback by it. I really was. And I went. I was going away on holiday just after that happened, and there was a lot going on, and I just deleted the Twitter app, and I had two blissful weeks off, and it was quite easy. But I like being on there because I feel like there's still more positivity than there is negativity, albeit I do feel that balance is changing. It's like the Betfair Forum. I mean, when the Betfair Forum first started, it was a really fresh way for people to be able to express quite radical views, and it was good, but then it turned pretty toxic quite quickly, I thought. So, you know, I haven't been anywhere near that for God knows how long, and don't miss that one iota. And it may be that Twitter will become that way sometime, in which case, you know, I might do the same again. But for the time being, I think it's a really good way of promoting what we do. It's a good way of getting interesting views from people. And like I say, largely it's a lot more beneficial for me to be on it than it is, you know, a pain. There are times where you cannot believe how kind of vitriolic or how, you know, twisted people's views of what you do can be. But, you know, there's also other times where you get criticised and you think, well, actually, that's totally valid. And I mean, I'll give an example. Recently, there was a race, I think it was at Ascot, and two horses fell at the last, and they're pretty crashing falls. Within about half an hour, we put a couple of pictures up of the fall. Now, we made it absolutely clear that jockeys and the horses were completely fine, but straight away, the responses to that were, you know, you shouldn't put this up, this is no good, this looks terrible, look, it's too soon after the race. And I looked at that, and I thought, you know what, I agree with that. And so I got in touch with the office, said, look, just take those down. There's no value to using those. And so therefore you learnt from what you were being told. But, you know, there are also other times where, and it's not so much me, but it's the staff. We've got such great staff. They're passionate. They try really hard. They're knowledgeable. They're brilliant. And I don't like seeing them get slagged off on Twitter. That really does me. But, you know, that's the world we live in. And, you know, for the time being, Twitter's fine with me. There might come a time when something else comes along that might be slightly less toxic, and I'll give that a go.
Did you feel that in your position you have some sort of responsibility to answer to the public, your readership on that sort of platform?
Yeah, I do. And I do a lot of responding to people. You know, unless someone is just downright rude or abusive or willfully wants to take issue with what I'm doing, despite logic and good sense saying otherwise, I will respond to people. It's when they become incessant or personal or abusive or just pointlessly rude that I will block or just disengage them, because there's no value in that. But like I say, if someone's got a view and they're prepared to listen and debate in the same way that I am, then I'll try and talk them around for sure, because I think it's important that, you know, people come away understanding what we do and why.
So finally, highlights and lowlights of your career so far, and that can include the early days before you became the editor.
I can't pick out highlights or lowlights, really, to be honest. I mean, look, I think when we make mistakes, that's obviously problematic. And there's been a couple of mistakes that, you know, you do have your head in your hand, and, you know, they cause a lot of grief. But unfortunately, in a live publishing environment, you know, we've got a fantastically professional team of journalists, and we all do our absolute best. But very occasionally something goes wrong that, you know, goes badly wrong, and that's hideous. But I think, you know, ultimately working with such a talented team, working with such brilliant people, you know, and creating so much great content on a daily, hourly basis, it just gives me, you know, a lot of joy. I love the fact that we've made such a good, successful digital transformation. And the job has changed massively in the 10 years I've been doing it, and, you know, every day brings something new and something different, and I couldn't be luckier.
Look out for our regular money back offers, including Pipped in the Post on selected horse racing and Saved by the 90s for all Premier League and televised championship matches. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.